the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Apex and Westwave Audio. Now from the Nowcast Network Studios, here's Mike.
Hey, welcome to the Audio Nowcast. My name is Mike Rodriguez, and before we get going, let me introduce the guys. Over here on my right, we've got Scott Gershon.
Hi, Mike.
And across the table, we've got Andrew Sheps.
Hey, Mike.
And next to him, we've got Rob Arbitier.
Hello, Mike.
Ladies and gentlemen, that was the third time that we tried that intro.
And I thought that was great, though.
Yeah, I thought so, too.
We all remembered your name and everything.
That's right. And I remembered your names.
Excellent.
Well, guys, this is show number 48. Can you believe that? 48. Wow, who would have thunk? Huh? Hey, do any of you guys, have you hacked any hardware? Have you ever hacked any hardware?
It's been a really long time. It used to be that in the early days of, like, big workstations and stuff, you'd find out about different ways to get hard drives to send their data faster or, you know, ways to get memory to flush faster and things like that. But it's been a really long time.
Yeah, I mean, the reason why I'm asking this is because lately there's a couple things that I just want to get back into soldering and wires and just getting back in, like, I don't know, in touch with the music. And I'm looking at maybe getting an analog synth. I mean, a modular analog synth.
Oh, well, that would be cool.
And because you can do some hot wires. I've seen some really cool things that guys have done with it. And,
you know, I don't know that gets you back in touch with music. I think it gets you back in touch with not having any free time.
Well, we also had a discussion at the end of the last podcast and about, you know, Andrew was talking about maybe getting a pipe organ. And I just thought that was, talk about the ultimate hack. How fun would that be? I mean, how's that going?
It hasn't happened yet. It hasn't happened yet. It's still available as far as I know, but it's in Kansas and it's huge and I don't know. I haven't really figured it out.
Well,
yet.
You got to describe it because just.
All right. Well, I don't know how technical to get. Basically, it's an 11 rank organ, which means it has 11 full sets of pipes. And then the console for it has two manuals, so two keyboards plus the pedals.
Right.
And then depending on how you configure things, you can start tying the sets of pipes together. So you have different stops based on having different sets of pipes on one or both keyboards or tying the pedals to it. And so, I mean, the combinations are ridiculous. It's like 40 or 50 different stops on those 11 ranks of pipes. But it's huge. I mean, the blower alone weighs 850 pounds or
Holy
something
smokes.
Like that. It's insane.
Is that going to be FedEx now?
Yeah. I was thinking, second day to save some money.
So is this something we need to expand the house?
Well, it needs a big room. I mean, you know, I think it's a sort of a myth that you have to put it in a big echoey church.
Right.
But it literally, I mean, when you look at a lot of synth patches and things and they talk about 8 foot and 16 foot when you have organ patches, that's literally the length of the pipe that makes that note. And
right.
So this organ has 16 foot pipes that are the lowest ones. And I know Rob, when he was growing up, had used an organ that had 64 foot pipes.
It had a 64 foot pipe.
Which is
Holy
ridiculous.
Smokes. That's like having 14 chimneys outside your house or something.
No, it's like having a Ford, like a very small Escort with a subwoofer. That's what it's like. It's ridiculous.
Now do all the pipes, if you got them, do they all have to be in the same place, or how does the air get distributed?
Well, yeah, you've got
you put some like in
basically,
your bedroom
I mean,
and throughout your
what
house?
They have is there are what they call wind chests, and then there are offset chests and things like that. So you can route the air however you want, but the idea is you want to have the same air pressure available at all the pipes. So when you hit a key on the console and it flips open the little valve underneath the pipe, the right amount of air is going through. And then you control the volume with a pedal that's literally controlling the airflow to these pipes and things like that. I mean, it's a purely mechanical thing. You know, it's relays and it's magnets and it's wind and
see, I
do the MIDI version.
I say get it. You need to get it. You need to get it and then
I'd
get a tuxedo.
Like to. No, I don't need the tuxedo.
Yeah, I want to see you sitting there in the black tuxedo and I want you to go da 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 da.
Exactly. We'll see, and it would go next to the modular synth.
Exactly.
And the carousels outside.
Now, and also with hardware hacking, I want to mention, because this is exactly what you're talking about, and unfortunately I don't have the author's name, but we can look it up in the break
sure.
and give more specific information, but I just got a book called Handmade Electronic Music, and it's written by a guy whose name we'll look up, and it's based on a class that he's been teaching, I believe, at a university in New York, and it's all about go get the speaker out of your old radio and put a cork in the middle and solder it with these five components and hook it up to your old CD-ROM drive from your computer, and here's how to make it make music.
Wow.
And it's just tons and tons of projects like that. And I've just got the book, so I haven't really gotten started, but it looks amazing.
Well, one of the things that has kind of fueled this this renewed interest in hacking is there's a great website called Create Digital Music. I don't know if any of you guys have ever been to that, but I read that all the time. And they have all kinds of, posts about guys who've made instruments at about everything from old Speak and Spells to Game Boys.
And yes, the Speak and Spells are a real popular one for some reason.
Yeah. And music is coming out in just the strangest places. Like, for the Nintendo DS, Korg is actually putting out a little synthesizer that you can run on the Nintendo DS. And it's released in Japan and they're going to release it worldwide. And that's just so cool.
I worked with a band this is a rock band, and they would write their songs on some game on, I believe, the Xbox, where you could like do really, really basic sequencing, and that's how they'd put together tracks. And
wow.
Like, that's just what they use.
Yeah, I mean, the tones, and I don't know if it's the sounds or if it's the interface, you know, just that gives you just a little bit of variation in how you can create the sound. I mean, Scott, I know you in your studio, you have a bunch of different controllers that you use, you know, to control some of your sounds.
I mean, most people don't realize that a PS3 and an Xbox 360 is a synth. I mean, when we're doing sounds, it's a sample and disc player that's happening. So it would be actually not that difficult to be able to interface it to a streaming music system, something that you create or record into and just, you know, have to get some ADDs. But it's all there. It's just a giant DSP farm built into it. And many different companies everywhere, whether it be Weiss or FMod or Exact, they're all creating these little synth modules for the 360.
I think a lot of people are kind of getting back into hacking as kind of the natural, you know, for every action there's an opposite reaction. And so as synthesizers and DAWs are getting more powerful, people are reacting by going back to the basics and wanting to create music on their own and stuff. And I don't know, there's just something kind of cool about just hacking and making something that wasn't supposed to do one thing and changing it to something else. I mean, on a really small level, I got to tell you guys, we're going to do a consumer tip right now. Best Buy.
So, do we have a theme for that?
No, you know what? Go ahead, Scott. Go ahead. What's our theme?
That was it.
It was, you know.
Okay, Best Buy. They sold these SimpleTech drives, 320 gigabytes for $144. Okay, it's 340 2.5-inch notebook drive, 5,400 RPMs. Ugly, ugly, ugly. They were like this black cherry color and really just a horrible form factor. So I picked up one of those, went over to Fry's, got a $20 SATA interface, small little 2.5-inch drive, and I slapped some Velcro and put it on the back of my MacBook Pro, and I have another 320 gigs for $144. I mean, that was really cool, you know. Of course, I avoided the warranty on the hard drive. But, I mean, when was the last time anybody's ever used a warranty on a hard drive?
Oh, I have.
Yeah, once every year, maybe.
Really?
I bought a 750, and it died within about 3-4 months. Sent it back. Took about 8 months to get it back. But
the hard drive companies are real good about their warranties, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I figured, you know, once I turned it on and it worked and I wrote about 100 gigs to it and didn't have any problems, I voided the warranty and took it out of its case.
Actually, you probably didn't void the warranty of the drive. You just voided the warranty of that packaging of it.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The drive is probably still under warranty. They're real good about that, and you can usually just look up by serial number on the website, and it'll tell you right away if it's still in warranty.
Yeah, and they'll just – usually you send it in, they just send you back a bigger drive because that's what they've gotten. It's cheaper, and they don't want to fix it.
And it's usually a refurbished drive they send you back. But it's the same original warranty. Boy, we know way too much about this.
Yeah. It's happened. It's happened a few times.
Yeah, it has.
Well, anyway, I'm just kind of in this hacking mood, so I got to keep you guys updated to see if I go ahead and pull the trigger on getting a modular synth. I was looking at eBay and online, and there's a couple of them out there that look pretty cool, you know.
We all better check the wiring in our cars when we try to pull out of here. Mike's rewired them.
Well, you know, there's really, I learned synthesis on an old EMU modular system, and all just all the basic building blocks of electronic music are just right out there for you to do. You get the oscillator and you choose if you want a square, if you want a sawtooth, you want a sine wave, and you put it into the filter and you put it into the envelope and it just, it all made sense. And that's knowledge that serves me well even today, you know.
When absolutely. I just like having someone else doing the soldering. That's all.
Because I think there's a certain, you know, people that are growing up and getting into music right now, and to them, music is software, really. It's right. Not even keyboards anymore. It's software. And I think it just misses something, not having that tactile feedback of plugging in and, I don't know, just touching
knobs. Well, and
also
just understanding what is actually going on.
Yeah.
It's a big deal for synthesis. It's a big deal for acoustics if you're an engineer. I mean, you need to know what's actually happening, not just, the software does that, and it's cool.
Yeah, it's... The software is always emulating something.
Well,
so
yeah.
It's nice to know the thing it's emulating.
I remember we used to hack into the software, though. We used to get the little software editors, and you can go in and see the string.
Oh, yeah.
The strings, then you just change the words.
Well, it's been a while since that was easy.
Yeah.
And to be able to know what an LFO is, because you can see how an LFO can affect, you know, whatever you're using the LFO to control. And these are terms that are still useful today, but it just, is it really, do you really grasp the understanding that you would if you actually played?
Well, and at all, yeah, because what that always gave you was the understanding that, first of all, you could hook it up wrong and it might sound really cool, or right. You'd think you'd hooked it up right and absolutely nothing came out, and you had to figure it out.
Yeah,
you had to fix it. You didn't
case.
Start off with this incredibly, I mean, the other thing is, though, if you mess with a modular trying to make a cool synth patch, you'll think that you're like, oh man, this is great. And then you go hit preset one on anything else in the room.
That's
right.
True.
And I go, it's actually really simple, but you know exactly why it's doing what it's doing, which is huge.
But isn't the same thing, same concept available in the software modulars, like Reason?
Yeah, but you're not, it is there, but I don't know how many people just start from scratch and build themselves a patch. Even like the Moog modular, which you can get, which is the Moog modular, I'm sure 99% of the people who use it start from a preset and that's that.
Yeah, and you might be tweaking the filter, opening it up, or maybe closing it a little bit to change the characteristics.
Oh, it's fun, the Moog modular.
Oh, it is? It's a lot of fun. Very
convenient. Rob and I spend many days just kind of screwing with that thing.
Yeah, that thing is really cool.
Well, anyhow, I will, you know, and Andrew, buy the organ. That's all I can tell you.
Mike just wants the photo op.
to be a pipe organ geek, I actually put contact Mike. Oh, sorry. Well, I went to Magic Mountain years ago, and I don't know if you realize that what's holding the Viper up are giant hollow tubes. And when the roller coaster goes by, it puts air and vibrates the tubes. So I put contact mics as high as I can get them on all the different tubes at Magic Mountain, and I've got all these weird tones.
To be pretty cool.
Yeah, I did it actually put it in the doors. So when they're getting all like psychotic and kind of drugging out, it's actually all the sounds from the Viper roller coaster.
Wow. And so the air gets...
Yeah, they're hollow. And what happens is they start vibrating and you can hear the air moving back, and it's this really psychedelic, weird, drug-induced. And they had all different heights and they're all different thicknesses.
Wow.
So you can go through and they all make tones.
That's kind of cool.
Because what I did was I walk in around. I said, what's that ringing? So I started putting my ears against each of the tubes.
Wow.
I went, ooh.
Well, you know, one of these shows, we need to do one on circuit bending. That's what you call it. The whole community of people that do all this homemade instruments.
Well, I got to read this book first.
Yeah.
Get a head start.
That's what we're going to do. We're going to do it. Note to self, podcast idea, circuit bending. Well, anyhow, I was talking about technology, and I don't know if you guys have been monitoring the whole, what's happening in the world of the music labels and how they're trying everything to make up for this massive amount of pirating that's going on and causing their sales to go down the tube, and, you know, people are losing jobs, yada, yada, yada. I personally think it's just the crap that they're putting out. But, you know, there's a certain amount of validity behind some of their reasoning in the piracy. But what I wanted to talk about was the fact that it seems what they're trying to do now is tax the technology. And one of the ideas is that the ISPs pay like a $5 fee on, you know, your broadband internet connection, and that fee gets divided up like royalties to the different artists depending on how many artists got downloaded or transferred, you know, on peer-to-peer sites.
So they're talking about actually tracking the downloads and splitting it based on downloaded?
Yeah, see, you know what? I don't know much more into that. You know, it's one of these things where they want the money first and figure out how to...
Yeah, I have a feeling that very little of that $5 makes it back to the artist.
Well, it's like the RAAA, you know, with all those lawsuits. You read online that, you know, the artist... They're going to have to sue to get that money when it was their music.
You know what the analogy that it reminds me of? Like in the old days, that would have been like trying to get $5 from the trucking company that delivers the blank cassettes the store. You know, it seems complicated and.
Well, I just wanted to bring to the table, you know, and see how you guys felt since we're all, you know, in the biz in one way or another. And I mean, to me, going on to the assumption that people are just going to be, you know, unethical and download music. And so everybody's doing it, so you might as well, you know, tax everybody because everybody.
So I like the subscription method where people subscribe to a forum and then download as much music as they want.
Well,
or a number of music.
A lot of these movements are being driven by, you know, managers and ex-managers of big acts. And to me, you know, I don't know. I just think they're looking out for, like, you know, Paul McGinnis had a really famous speech at the Mid, what was the name of that festival?
Midem.
Yeah, at Midem. And he's talking about, you know, maybe we should tax the technology. Maybe the iPod should be given, you know, a certain amount of percentage of what they cost to a fund because they're making the music and they're benefiting from the creative process of these people, so hey, it only seems fair that.
Yeah, but they're not taxing the computers for all of the software manufacturers who've lost money because of piracy. And that's an absolutely parallel example.
Right.
It's a software company. I mean, in this environment, digitally, the music companies are software companies. And no other software company is going after the money in that way. They try better copy protection, which in the music thing doesn't work as well because you're really turning people off at that point. But it doesn't make any sense.
I have a hard time with the whole, you know, assumption that people are just pirating. I know there's pirates and quite frankly, there will always be people that are going to pirate music. And even when there was no broadband, even when it was just cassettes, people were, hey, let me tape that or let me get this or can I make a copy of that? But it just seems really, I don't know. I think if the big boys want to do that for their big artists, you know, where does the little guy get money?
I think
this whole thing?
It's complicated and it's a plan that'll come and go is what it seems like.
But it's getting a lot of steam.
Well,
no,
they always get a lot of coverage, but nothing ever gets implemented.
I mean, I think it would be really, really, I don't know. I don't want to pay another $5 on my broadband connection, and I want my connection to be as fast as humanly possible.
But you don't think, like, if Universal Music, you can go to their site, subscribe to it, and they have advertisers because a lot of the kids, you know, want – the jean companies want to get out there, and the elephant and the big dog T-shirts and everything wants to go to sell to these kids within a genre of music. Are you saying that there's not revenue that can be created?
Oh, absolutely.
In
you
that,
know what?
As well as – people pay a subscription. They can download X amount at a time, and
that's a different thing, though. If you get an advertiser to subsidize,
well, it's a combination of both.
Right, but that's not what he's talking about.
No,
he's
talking about
them taxing the actual technology companies.
Right, but talking about another different kind of model.
I mean, you're paying. Here's the thing that I think is flawed in the whole logic of taxing technology. You know, when you have someone saying that they should get a cut of the MP3 player that you playback something because they're creating something to playback on the MP3 player. You know, if it wasn't for that MP3 player, you wouldn't be you know, listening to their music in the first place? What are you going to do, listen to radio? You know, I mean,
no, I mean, the people that like the Fraunhofer MP3 codec or whatever, if you need to license that codec, well, fine, because that's an actual technology to use the stuff. But the stuff itself can't get a piece of the thing that plays it back. That's, I mean, the record companies didn't get a piece of turntables or cassette players or. And now here's something I wanted to ask about, because I remember this whole argument about taxing blank media.
Yeah.
Did it ever even happen? Am I remembering wrong, or did they actually implement it in Canada for a minute and then it went away?
I thought I remember hearing that it was implemented someplace.
The
percentage of cassette sales was actually going back to the labels.
You know, the CDRs for music, if you see CDRs for music, those were actually taxed and could only, I don't know if you noticed this, but if you had a component CDR, a music CDR, not a computer, you couldn't record a computer CDR with it. You'd have to use a CDR made for music.
Right, for a little bit.
Yeah, but
okay, so how did that work, and how much of that money ever made it anywhere?
You know what? That, I don't know, because all people had to realize was the fact that you could do it on your computer and
yeah,
use cheaper.
Just,
I mean, so why aren't people looking at that? I mean, they're coming out with this like, oh, I got a great new idea that's exactly the same as the idea they had about 5 years ago or 10 years ago. And
the fact that peer-to-peer, you know, just the whole peer-to-peer process in the first place, pipes are getting so big that you don't have to go to a peer-to-peer to download something. They have websites that you can go to, or they're nothing but giant vaults. And if you know, if you get the link that has that password to that giant vault, you can get in there and you can download directly without going peer-to-peer on a way faster connection, anything you want, really. But the thing is knowing, you know, it's a close, because you got to know who put this stuff up, and you got to know the link to get to it. But it just seems to me, they're so far behind. They've never been ahead of technology, let alone with technology.
Exactly.
That they're always levering the attacks or doing the reacting. You know, it's like, you know, getting your kid in trouble for something he did, you know, 3 days ago, you know, and they're just behind the times. I don't know. I just think it really.
Well, and they're also going after the wrong thing. Like, they're going after the symptom of how it's changed, as opposed to trying to get ahead of the next change or how to monetize what's already changed. They're just like, oh, it went like that? Well, boy, we better charge him for that. Well, you can't.
Yeah.
You can't.
I just think it's desperation. It's really weird. I mean, it seems like we talk about this all the time, but things are changing all the time in this whole battle between the record companies and the consumers. And unfortunately, the people that are caught in the middle are a lot of the artists and a lot of the smaller artists, you know, and they're kind of doing an end around by doing all their independent thing. And meanwhile, you've got these big record companies they're looking for some type of direction to keep their whole business model afloat. But I just don't know if it's going to stay afloat, you know.
But what I think is going to happen is the next generation of technology is not a traditional PC. It's not going to be where you plug in Word and, oh, by the way, you listen to your music. A lot of the computers are now hooking to your stereos. A lot of it's DirecTV. A lot of it, one of the biggest things that Microsoft is concerned about is you don't need Windows anymore. When you look at there's a couple of things that came out by Sony that aren't using a Windows platform. They're using more of an internet platform.
Right.
All the cell phone companies, they're not necessarily using Windows either. So what's happening is other platforms that are coming out that, while they are literally computers, they're not going to look like your computer. They're going to be your downloadable blah blah device.
Well, the Apple TV.
Yeah.
Well, that's true. It's you look at you look at Blu-ray players, and everybody's, hey, Blu-ray won. They won. And you're thinking, are you going to get a Blu-ray? Well, if you want the PS, you know, the PlayStation 3, maybe. But if you've got an Apple TV, you know, that might be the new paradigm. You may be just,
I know a lot of people that are downloading on the 360 and watching movies off the 360.
Yeah, so that'll be really interesting to see who's going to win on that one. I don't know. I just think right now, you know, I know we've covered this, but I just, you know, I just think they're going the wrong direction with how they're attacking this whole thing.
Well, and hopefully the movie industry is paying attention and will do it right, because they're on the brink of the bandwidth being enough that they're going to go down exactly that same road, and we'll see what they do. And I think things like Apple TV and iTunes movie rentals is exactly the way to do it. You monetize it and make it easy,
right?
And then people will do that, because, as you say, to get a fast connection to download the stuff for free, you can do it, but it's kind of difficult. If there's a super easy and cheap way to do it, people will pay.
Well, yeah. You know what? I will have to give them some props. I mean, you look at Universal, and they just launched their Hulu site. Are you guys familiar with that?
Mm-hmm.
HULU.com?
Yeah, it was basically to get all their stuff off of YouTube and be able to control it better.
Right.
So they launched Hulu.
And to be honest, it works pretty darn good. You can watch episodes of, you know, some of your favorite NBC shows, and you know, I was at work and I had a couple hours to burn because there wasn't anything to mix at that time. And so I hopped on and I ended up watching a couple episodes of some TV shows. And I was like, it's pretty impressive.
But
and
there are commercials.
Right, which is fine.
Well, but some people want to be able to,
there's some people
download
who,
the stuff without.
Well, that's the thing. I'm sure. And what's smart is you set it up with a model of, hey, you want it for free, watch the ads. You want to pay, download it right now with no ads. And that would work fine, because I know plenty of people who would be adamant in favor of one or the other, so make them both available.
Yeah, it would seem to me that
would be smart.
Rather than looking at the internet radio stations as a threat like that they've done by, you know, some of the fees that they imposed and stuff like that, if they made it a little bit more viable, you know, they really could their distribution can be bigger than they've ever were with radio.
But don't you think also the mobile technologies are going to start outpacing even PCs?
You know what? Because absolutely.
Because you look at the Apple, you look at whether it be the iPhone or the iTouch, and you're going, wow, I can have all – I mean, I bought a Motorola Q, so you hear a beeping on my jacket. That's every time I get an email, it has a little beep. So I can check all my email from my cell phone. Now, all of a sudden, we go to our computers a lot less because we've got a lot of the same information on our mobile technologies.
You're absolutely right. I mean, you can do iTunes directly from your iPhone now with a Wi-Fi connection. And really, you know, if that gets some serious drive space, some serious memory, why even back it up to, you know, to your computer? You could have some other device that you can back up your library to.
Well, or it's something like Rhapsody where none of it's really local anyway. You kind of listen to whatever you want to based on a subscription thing, but you don't actually download ever. You're like, I'm going to listen to that, and it just starts
live
streaming.
Streaming.
Yeah. I mean, because memory, I mean, hard drives, I mean, when I look at the drive, 320 gigs for $144, that's almost, you know, incomprehensible just 2 years ago.
Well, I think one thing that would be really interesting, and I'm hoping there's some coverage of it, is I hope there were some people at South by Southwest interviewing all these young bands, because what the labels want to do is one thing, but what do all the bands want to do that the labels are hoping to make money off of? And I would bet that most of the unknown bands were not at South by Southwest to get signed. They were there to get people to hear their stuff so maybe they'd buy directly.
And to come to their MySpace page.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, look, if REM is playing showcases, they're the ones promoting their album.
Right.
You know, the little band that's not signed is no longer going there to get signed, because nobody's getting signed at South by Southwest anymore. So you've got 2,500 bands, and probably 2,200 of them are all young and trying to figure it out. And I'd love to know what they think, because I'm sure that they're not excited about signing a 360 deal with a label so that they can get, what, a millionth of a penny out of that $5 on everybody's ISP connection. They're not interested.
Yeah.
You know, none of that's coming back to any new act.
But yet at the same time, you know, and we've talked about this, and we're not going to beat this dead horse, but you look at the label, and when you're a band, there's still, if somebody said, hey, we're going to give you a deal, you know, there's a certain amount of, you're not going to like go, no, you know?
But I don't know I think if it comes up, almost every band would take it, and maybe they shouldn't or whatever, depending on the situation. But I don't think it used to be that that's all any band ever thought about. Like, that was it. That's the goal. That's the only reason you do this other than playing the live shows for your friends or whatever. But in terms of a business model, it was to get signed. And that's where it began and ended. And now, I mean, I think that's more of an aberration.
Yeah, it is.
That's true.
I think everybody realizes now that if you sell enough stuff on your own, the labels will come after you later. You might actually get a reasonable deal at that point, but at that point you may not need one either.
You know, we're gonna end this part right now, but let me ask you guys, just in the whole food chain of bands, I sense that there's like holes developing on the lower and the lower mids. I mean, not the low level, the guys that are starting, but the guys that used to be like really strong regional pulls and would go up to a label and be able to get their label and make that jump to go huge. There just doesn't seem to be a lot of those bands anymore. You know, think of the last couple bands that have broke that made that jump to that giant level. I don't know. There's still some, but not as many.
No, because it used to be that the labels would be financing them to do regional tours.
Exactly.
And they kind of bring them up. But I think that what's happening now is promoters are starting to sign bands. And I think they're still signing a little bit in the upper middle class of bands. Like if you're already pulling lots of people, hey, we'll get you an opening slot on a bigger tour or something. But I think they're going to get smart. And there are already networks of clubs. Like if you can get a gig at one house of blues, you can play them all. And in the UK, they're the barfly clubs. If you can play at one of them, you could play at all of them. You can do an entire UK tour playing barflies. And those are tiny bands that can do that. You know, once if they can be good in the little club circuit around one of the barfly clubs, then the manager of that barfly will kind of pick them up and send them on the tour of the other ones. And I think that's where that'll come from.
But do you see any of those bands jump into the upper echelons? I just don't see a lot of crossovers on that jump. I see them
well,
come out
what,
there.
Well, what defines is them it, as being upper echelon? At the moment, it's still being on a label, which I think that's the thing, is that the upper echelon hasn't been defined for bands to come up to now. It's only – if you were already there 5 years ago, yeah, you're probably still there. But no one's getting pulled up.
Yeah, I just, you're right. It seems like the band is kind of a endangered species at that level. I mean, you've got the established acts, and you've got a couple acts that are kind of slowly breaking through.
You've got Alanis Morissette opening for Matchbox 20.
Yeah.
You know, she's won how many Grammys, sold how many millions of records, and she's taking, and it's a good spot, but, you know, she's not even trying to go out and headline a tour right now. She's like, I'll just open for these guys. I mean, it's insane to me.
That is insane because she could probably do it, absolutely do a House of Blues circuit and make, I would imagine, make money too, especially on that circuit because it's not that difficult.
But so you could say that that's kind of an upper middle class slot, right?
Yeah.
Opening up for Matchbox 20.
Yeah.
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 And, you know, she's decided that it's better for her to drop down and take that. Because I don't, like you said, I don't think she would have to. She could headline a tour in smaller venues
right.
and play sheds, but. You know, she's decided that's the way to go.
I don't know. I just think the confusion that their record labels are having and I think there's just a lot of confusion in the marketplace. And I think it's affecting every nook and cranny.
I think it's the same confusion that's going on Wall Street right now. Nobody has any idea what's actually going on.
Yeah.
The one thing that isn't confusing, though, and it's the reason that MySpace has become such a force, is that if an act, if it's a band or an artist or whatever, can establish a relationship with their audience – and build a loyal following, people are less likely to bootleg stuff from someone that they feel invested in, that they would want to go see live or whatever. If you build a relationship with your audience, which is something the record companies really don't do now, I mean, they'll fling any possible single at the radio,
right.
and, you know, it's about whether it gets traction or not. But if you build that relationship with the audience, I mean, like it used to be in the old days, you'd be excited about somebody's new product coming out.
It's Bruce Springsteen. I remember when Bruce Springsteen was coming out. In New Jersey, it was like, have you heard this guy? Have you heard this guy? No, I haven't heard of this guy. Kind of Bruce Springsteen. Man, the guy does like 3-hour concerts, 4-hour. He just plays and plays. What an amazing show. And everyone's like, I don't know who that is.
And you have people from 30 years ago who used to go see him 20 years ago, whatever. Who are still invested in his career because of the impact he had on them back then. That's something that you don't see the mainstream labels worrying about at all now. But MySpace is proof that if you really do build a relationship with your fans, you can be successful.
But even MySpace, you know, when we say MySpace is proof, it's definitely has a surge, but it hasn't been around long enough to see how it's going to sustain. I mean, because you have a lot of artists that are getting up and people are into MySpace, but to sustain that excitement, to sustain that.
Well, that's up to the artist. But the thing that MySpace has proven is that there are a whole bunch of bands that have been able to sell some product
right?
because of MySpace that in the old days wouldn't have been able to because they weren't big enough for a major.
Well, I mean, some of the biggest albums now are like High School Musical, Cheetah Girls.
Well, but that's mega corporate.
Right, but no. But that's exactly what they've got a machine.
But the whole thing about MySpace, and I mean, and Roy Ashen was a great example of this, is that if you're on MySpace, 15,000 copies is the new 150,000 copies.
Well, no, that's true.
Because that's the money you're making. You don't need to be like getting huge. You just need to be steady and sell a decent number of thousands, and you're fine, and you're making a living.
I mean, I would be curious to see what a flash in the pan in MySpace is going to look
like.
Well, you know,
who's the girl who slept with Spitzer?
yeah.
Apparently, she wants to put out an album.
Flash.
So.
They had to take down her MySpace page.
Yeah,
6 million hits.
Really?
Yeah.
They have to take it down.
Well,
yeah,
it's, I just think it's going to be the thing. Here's the thing about MySpace. It's great. It's a single channel. You know, and I think in the old days when you had promotion, you had more than one avenue to promote yourself. Well, the record labels would promote you,
but they'd
in
have
the
to
music
spend
store.
A fortune,
right?
To do it.
But also, they'd spend a fortune, but they'd make a fortune too, and you'd have a ton of acts out there, and you'd have big acts, and they'd be doing big things.
Yeah, except you'd have like one or two big acts paying for all the promotion for all the other acts that weren't making it.
Yeah, I mean, that was the theory in the 70s.
But don't you think in the 60s and 70s, a lot of the acts were nurtured and grown and harvested and now...
I was a kid, a baby in the 60s.
But the thing is, but now it's all about, well, I want a band, it's got to be big, we want to make a lot of money,
some ways, I mean, it's great that at that point they could have the business model where they said, well, one established act will pay to develop 12 acts, and one of those 12 will in several years become the established act that will finance the next 20 or whatever. But now every act has to stand on its own merits, which is another reason, well, if that's the case, what do you need the label for? Because that's exactly how it has to be if you're on your own.
Yeah. Yeah. I just think I totally see your point of view. Although I just remember looking back in the 80s and looking – you open up the calendar section in the Los Angeles Times and you'd see, you know, giant tour after giant tour playing at all the different big venues. And nowadays,
well, and you'd also see the Sunset Strip packed with people on a weekend. And now, man, if your band finishes playing at 11:30 on a Saturday, it's empty.
Yeah.
There's nobody there.
And I just think there's as much as artists are having control over their, you know, their destiny, there's just a giant hole that's opening up, a giant void. And I don't know how it's going to get filled, and I don't know the economics to fill
that. But
it may not
get filled.
And
that's
a shame.
It may be that void of lots of big things is actually being taken up by thousands of small things, and you just can't tell.
Yeah, people may not hunger so much for the big things as the way the labels would always have hoped.
Yeah,
or wanted you to believe.
Well, on that depressing thought.
and you know where they're also trying to promote music now is also video games. Video games and TV.
Yeah, you're absolutely right on that. Well, hey, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about a few other things, not just the depressing news of the music industry and the giant void. All right, we'll catch you on the other side.
You're listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Aphex and Westwave Audio. Have a question for the panel? Would you like to be a guest on the Audio Nowcast and live in the LA area? Email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com.
Hey, welcome back to the Audio Nowcast. And before the break, we were talking about the death of music and how everything's going down to crap.
No.
But I was corrected. Because
all the facts are the same, but it's not that depressing.
Yeah.
I think it's good.
Ken is joining us because he was the first one to say that it wasn't depressing. Why is it not depressing, Ken, that we're losing a whole level of market?
I like small shows. I like the new festivals. I mean, they're not new, but I like that there's a lot of them now. And I like watching Bret Michaels on Rock of Love.
That's the last time he's on the show.
Stadium tours, who cares? I mean, you know, it's way up in the nosebleeds.
Actually, there's something to be said for that, being out there, and looking at everybody that's, 2 inches tall and...
I don't know. There's a certain excitement.
Hearing all the delays.
It was exciting, yeah. But
about going to a giant show when you go to a big show.
It's true, but how many people at that show will regale you for hours with the story of when they saw that band at the beginning in a club and how unbelievable it was?
Yes.
I mean, I saw the Chili Peppers in 86 in a really small club, and it was insane. And their stadium show is amazing, but it's – not the same. So, you know, you can argue both ways for all of this stuff, I would say.
Well, stadium shows, I think you're right. When you stadium shows are almost too big sometimes. I mean,
you wouldn't want to see Michael Jackson in a club.
Right. And nowadays.
These days.
And nowadays, you just wouldn't want to see Michael Jackson.
Hey, easy. Easy. From all sides.
I know. I just. But there's a certain, you know, the technology of the show has definitely gotten better. But like, Universal Amphitheater size, that shed size tour where you could see a act in a shed.
But you can still see them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Those were.
Who wants to be,
phenomenal.
You know, half a mile back?
But the
back.
Thing is Universal and the Greek, they're booked every day all summer.
Yeah,
someone's playing them.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think there are a lot of markets that we don't know anything about, or at least I certainly
hockey
don't.
English.
I mean, there's some guy playing three nights at Universal, a Latin artist. I've never heard of him. But, well, you know, he's huge.
No, that's true, too. You're right. There's different levels of.
So it's fragmented the same way. Everything else about it is fragmented. So it used to be you probably knew every big act that was touring, and you'd heard at least a couple of songs, and you may not have liked it, but, you know, you wouldn't go see Bread, but you'd go see whoever. But now, you know, I haven't heard of probably 80% of the acts out there playing that size show, and you're laughing about Bread.
Bread. Of all the bands.
Well, I was just thinking, like, what band would I absolutely not go see, and that would be them.
That's awesome.
Sorry.
That's awesome.
But they were huge, right, for a minute?
Absolutely. Like,
yeah.
Bread.
There you go. That's what I'm saying.
When I was, you know, what was
that's
like,
what
eight?
I'm saying.
I don't know.
Chicago, Bread.
I think
America.
It'll be interesting to see what happens. All right. Well, enough of that. Let's move forward. I want to talk about a few things. And since we're kind of talking tech and we're talking hack and all that, I want to talk about the computer and power. And why does it seem that as soon as Intel comes out with a chip, and as soon as Apple releases a computer that takes advantage of the chip, all of a sudden all your software just will not run well unless you get that chip?
Because it's Apple.
They're all in bed together.
Meanwhile, Windows doesn't do that. Windows theoretically runs all the old stuff.
Well, actually,
that's why it takes them 5 years to come up with a new operating system.
Because before the
podcast. We're not talking about being incompatible, just about. Like, is your computer fast enough to run the latest
exactly.
version?
Exactly. And what were you talking about before
well,
the podcast?
Well, I just saw something on the way in about Intel's bringing out 6-core chips, and the technology is scalable to 8-core. So they're going to have 8-core processors sometime this year.
That's like – that's amazing. That is just – you know, you're having a little mini computer.
And DigiSize still doesn't have Leopard out, so, you know.
Yeah.
It's not blessed for Leopard yet?
No.
No. HD is.
No,
yeah,
but not Ellie.
Interesting. Good to know. But it just seems like, I don't know, it just seems like, you know, right when you start thinking you have enough, right when you start thinking, hey, yeah, I'm getting ahead of the curve, you know, right when I get a 320 gig hard drive, next thing you know it, you've got Logic that has, you know, 56 gigs worth of stuff, and you've got.
But all you used to do on your computer was like type letters, and now you're watching TV shows. So, I mean, it's the whole paradigm's changed of what a computer does.
There's nothing stopping you, though. If you're getting work done, I mean, I still haven't moved up to Vista on any of my Windows systems that are critical for music. If you're getting the work done, there's no rule that says you have to advance. You can let a few iterations of the technology go by and wait until it does something you really can't live without. You don't have to ride that roller coaster, even though the tendency is to want to.
See, I have to. I mean, I just have to keep up with the updates, you know? I'll tell you the programs that
yeah,
I have.
But then, buying a new computer
but then
is not
buying the stuff
no,
that
no,
never
no.
works.
What do you mean?
Well, the updates. They say, hey, we just came out with it. Oh, you know, it's like the one version, you know, one or version 0.9.
Yeah.
I always want the, you know, 1.8.
Yeah, but like with Ableton, I always buy their – I always want to stay on the latest because they're pretty good about their stuff. And Reason's another one. You always want to stay up with them. And then, you
but
know,
you need the latest computer for it?
No, but I'm just talking about in general, just you get into this whole cycle of just the whole upgrade that, you know, that
well, you know, they used to do cars. The cars used to be bigger or faster. It's not like you could actually drive any faster, you know, legally. But you wanted bigger, more, faster, stronger.
You have to – I mean, if you're a professional in the music industry or audio, you have to make the decision about whether – because it is a business decision whether to upgrade or not. And you have to make the decision, the money I'm going to outlay, you know, am I going to have some tangible benefit? Is my product going to be better because of it? Because there have been plenty of times, like it's definitely happened in the Apple world, where you'll buy a new computer, you'll buy a new operating system, you'll have to get all new versions of your software, and you will end up exactly where you started feature-wise. You can't do anything different. You might be able to do it slightly faster,
right,
but you've spent – I mean, that happened with Pro
thousands of dollars.
So
yeah,
many times where absolutely. You'll spend sometimes dozens of
the
thousands
Mactel.
Of dollars. Yeah.
Going to Mactel, all of a sudden I spend thousands of dollars with upgrades and plugins.
Oh, that's where I'm at.
Or PCIe Express.
Yeah.
I mean, there's been plenty of new technologies that have come. The truth is –
And you didn't get anything more.
You don't get anything more, and you have to make the decision of, is it really necessary?
But you definitely need to stay away from the conspiracy theory of, you know, like the software makers are bogging down their stuff.
No.
They don't have time. What happens is their software might be able to run faster, but they don't have the time or the expertise to optimize the code, possibly. But look at the features they're putting in. I mean, it's all real-time DSP that would – it would be insane on one track 5 years ago. And now it's like, yeah, 86 tracks of free-form time and pitch and – you know, and you don't even have to think about it. You don't have to render it. It just does it. And you wonder why you have to upgrade your computer. I mean, you know, because these guys are throwing these features in like, okay, and they get it so it can ship because they've got some sort of deadline. They could probably spend 8 months and do nothing but make that code run faster.
You know, this is a perfect segue into the feature we're going to do right now.
I do what I can.
Well, you know, let me derail for one quick moment.
Absolutely.
I need to
– Wait, he's changing the subject. That's
slightly. No, but it ties into this because every now and then you'll see a new technology that actually warrants new hardware or warrants, you know, new whatever to make it work. And at Music Mesa this year, I just saw a video of this.
Mm-hmm.
Celemony.
Holy crap.
Demonstrated some new technology. They're the ones who make Melodyne, which
right.
is the world's coolest pitch thing. Have
yeah.
you seen – the new stuff they're working on for
Melodyne.
What are they working on?
Oh, my God.
Okay, so you saw it.
Right, you got to tell me.
They have it working. This was worth derailing
this
the conversation.
This is definitely well worth it.
They now have a version of Melodyne in the works. It's not going to be out till the fall, but they have a version in the works that you can put polyphonic material in. Like you can play a guitar chord or a piano chord into it, and the individual notes within the chord show up on the screen, and you can change the individual notes from within chords – including if you played it on a guitar that was out of tune, you could tune the guitar after the fact.
Wait. It'll split the notes up?
It'll split the notes up. You
now,
see them on the screen.
The demo video, and they've done it. I mean, it is actually doing it, but it is, to be fair, it's a clean classical guitar.
Right. Well,
so,
it's very early in the technology development, but
it
does work.
It is ridiculous.
It is. It's incredible.
Now, see...
if it needed a new computer, it's the kind of program I'd buy a new computer for.
Yeah, absolutely. You buy a computer just to run this
thing. It's that cool.
Wouldn't it sound like a sample then?
No.
It sounds
you
real.
You can even check this out. You can take like the notes from within a guitar chord and change their timing. So if somebody played a low note, then a high note, then a mid note, you can change it so they played a high note, then a low note, then a mid note.
Finding the fundamental and then the
harmonic. I mean, if you think about it.
How does that do that? I mean, because they're so dependent. That sound is so dependent on the other note.
You know what? Look at the video.
Yeah, you have to watch the video.
Will.
The same way you have to go look at RX by Isotope, which is a noise reduction program, but it's the same sort of thing where they've got a recording. I think it's a live Miles Davis record in a club, and their glass is clinking, and they've got this bizarre spectrogram sort of representation of it, and you can see the clinking and select just the clinking and tell it adaptively fill that in based on the stuff on either side of it, and it goes away.
It's like
and it doesn't
Photoshop.
Affect
it's
the
like
piano
Photoshop.
Or the room sound, and this is like an old, noisy, weird recording.
Does it give you like a sonogram type of a display?
Yeah.
Something similar to what Adobe Audition does, where you can kind of find the dark spot in that, and you can fill it in with whatever else is around.
Yeah,
or
but
you
lots
can
of automated processes and a lot of artificial intelligence in the way it does it. And so this
and actually, it's a similar kind of technology probably.
But it actually figures out, instead of just sort of giving you blurs and saying, all right, you figure it out, it figures it out and draws the notes individually. And it's
incredible.
It's absolutely insane.
Because you easily have pitch detectors, so you can find out the fundamental.
Right.
Then you need to find the correlating harmonic
but
with it.
This is
multiple
fundamentals.
Being played at the same time in one source. I mean, and Peter's quote, the developer, his quote is something like, In theory, this is impossible, but in practice, it seems to be working.
Right.
I mean, it's that crazy to the point where he sort of like, we can't do this. And then it started working.
Well, I'd love to see the crazy accident that made that happen.
Well, you know what? Every few years, somebody comes out with a way to do something in the audio world that they end up writing a paper and everybody ends up doing it. If you remember years ago, you know, pitch shifting didn't sound very good and time compression and expansion didn't sound very good. And then some guy.
There was one white paper.
Yeah, he wrote a white paper and all the different manufacturers learned how to do this.
Like
there's
some mathematical DSP way of doing it, and all of a sudden everything sounds great.
That's when Serato happened. That's when a lot of stuff that Steinberg used to distribute happened.
Yeah.
And that is what this feels like now, like the new Isotope program and this new Melodyne. It seems, though, that what has happened is that technology of being able to figure out multiple fundamentals from within a complex signal has now been figured out. And that is now going to disseminate through the whole industry. And all kinds of people are going to do all kinds of cool stuff with it.
Well, yeah, because if you can do that with notes, then you're going to look at programs that are going to be able to strip vocals out of pre-recorded, you know, pieces of
eventually,
music
without
using the phase
reversal.
It's going
to have to happen.
You're going to look at, hey, let's do, I'd love to hear, you know, Stairway to Heaven without the guitar.
Like what we talked about last week with the multi-track of the Queen song, you'll be able to make it yourself.
You'll be able to make
it.
Man,
I made it eventually.
That.
But you should check out this video because it really, you know, I'm always skeptical because I feel like I've seen it all, but this was one of those things where I watched it and I said, I shouldn't be hearing what I'm hearing. And
it's
I'm
online.
Completely
but,
shocked.
But isn't it doing the equivalent of Adobe Photoshop with visuals? Find the red barn and get rid of it. So when they're taking an audio footprint, they can
it. No, what it's like a kind of, except it's saying you can remove the red barn and what the camera couldn't see that was behind it is there.
Right.
I mean, it's that.
Sure.
It's that much that, more involved.
You've got to hear it to believe it.
Well, you know, when you think about taking that technology to the next level, you're gonna see a whole industry of remastering that's gonna be huge because now you can take.
Okay, so
old
not
movies,
only is your song
talking about
off.
Karaoke.
Well, yeah,
you know,
but a couple. I will say about 7 years ago, I went. In Los Angeles, off of 3rd Street, a really bad area of town, I went to this guy's studio, and he had this process where he could take a mono track like Frankenstein, and he could isolate all the different elements, and he did a 5-1 remix of Frankenstein through some process, and it was voodoo.
This is the song, not the monster.
No. This is the movie.
Movie.
But he had all these boxes.
I thought he was doing Edgar Winter and didn't realize that was mono.
No. But he had all these weird boxes, and you walk into his studio, and it literally was like a mad scientist. He had gear all over the place, and it's the kind of place where he's taken off the. Like if it said Roland, he would have, you know, taken off the Roland because all the faceplates were all scarred up where he's taken off the different manufacturers. And it was amazing what he can do. And he was a little bit ahead of his time, but he was trying to, you know, get into remastering some of these old ones in like 5.1. Well, if you have this technology and if they develop it where you can start isolating those things, that's actually, you're going to see a big remastering industry.
Definitely.
Pop
it's
up.
Just about somebody reading that same white paper and figuring out that's what they want to build with it.
It's truly, and one of the best things about that video is they've got some guy with, who is American, but has obviously never done anything.
Meaty.
Take your meaty keyboard.
They didn't teach him that it's pronounced midi, so it's actually really funny.
It's all meaty.
It's meaty. It's not even subtle. It's meaty. I noticed that too. I thought that was really
funny. That's really funny.
That's amazing. That's amazing technology. I mean, cause I can see it, Scott. I can see some of those, you know, some of those movies that were made in the 70s and made in the 60s and the 50s. I could see that. You know,
yeah, I mean, I think at the moment it's probably much easier with musical content because you've got repeating waveforms and pitches that sustain and stuff like that. But it's going to go.
It's a matter of time.
You know what?
Check it out, though. Check out the video.
You lay the groundwork like Rob was saying with, you know, pitch sift, the first person that figured out how to do a pitch sift.
And but then, it's almost like green screen, though. You know, when you take somebody the early days, you see the artifacts around the people in the background, and it wouldn't be quite so convincing. So there'll probably be audio versions of that.
You know what?
Where there'll be just, you know, artifacts and crap around.
But the
it.
Thing is, green screen nowadays, you don't know what's green screened and what's
oh,
not.
Oh, no. The progress is
amazing. Well, yeah. No. Now it's progressed
so far. That's
what
I'm saying.
Yeah.
So with audio, it's going to be the same way. You're going to get to a moment in time where you're just
it's the first.
Know.
I was forwarded the link, and it's the first audio email I've gotten in a long time where the entire text of the email was Mother of God and a link.
Yeah.
And that's it.
No, that's how I got it, too. It wasn't exactly that, but yeah. People are forwarding it around because it's truly a revolution. And it takes, you know, it's maybe every 5 or 6 years that something like that comes along.
Which makes you wonder.
For $3.99.
Let me just.
No, I don't know about that.
Let's just take this to another level. Let's say you get this plug-in and you can manipulate your audio in all sorts of really great and interesting ways. Is that going to put a time limit on, you know, some of the great session players, because essentially you can now make anybody a great
session
player.
Well, it's the same. It's a new form of auto-tune and things like that, and I think everybody sees it differently. Some people see it as a way to fix crappy players, and some people see it as a way to save performances that would otherwise be unusable. And I mean, I think about some of the Johnny Cash stuff I worked on where he was not doing great, and you know, you needed to work on the tracks really hard to get stuff to work. And it wasn't because it wasn't great people. It's not like, oh, I can get my buddy to come in and play that. You wanted the people who were playing to have played it. But the more tools to let you use that stuff, the better, I think. You know, there will always be people using it for evil. There's no question.
Exactly.
Using it for evil.
You can't worry about that. It's a really positive creative tool, and it's a really amazing
step forward. I think it is.
I think, you know, session players, they've got – they can't get beaten anymore. I mean, they're just...
That's true, too.
It is what it is already.
There's already that great void. Oh, wait. No, it's a good thing. Sorry. Huh. Hey, you know what I was going to segue into?
That was quite a derailment right there.
Oh, but well worth it.
It was well worth
it. About that.
I thought you liked that.
Yeah, no, that was great. That was pretty awesome. Looking forward to seeing that demo. Where is that demo, by the way?
It's on the Celimony.
It must be on their site.
It's on the Celimony website. I mean, it's a direct link, but it's Celimony/something. Because I can't... It's something into note... Is the actual name of the
Direct thing. Note Access.
Direct Note Access. So it's Celimony/DNA or something.
You know, that's like seeing into your music, literally. You're gonna
it really
see,
is.
You're seeing
it'll
into
freak you
your
out.
Music.
It'll freak you out. It freaked me out.
Wow. I'm not going to watch it tonight before I go to bed.
No, definitely not.
I'll have nightmares.
Yeah.
No, what I was going to segue into when we were talking about this technology and all the love-hate relationship, I wanted to I was in a discussion with a listener who wanted me to bring this up, and I've been trying to bring this up the last couple podcasts, but I wanted to talk about gear that we hate. Does anybody have any gear that you absolutely hate or hated and now you like or hate and don't use it anymore? And because he asked me that question, and I absolutely had no problem answering him right off the bat. Gear that I hated.
Gear that we hate?
Well, the first one, obviously, is the all-time leader was the TX-16W, which was the worst sampler known to mankind. But the second one was, for me, I hated the first version of Giga Studio. It was the most buggiest piece of software. And Giga Studio now is phenomenal, but the first version of software was just...
I'd have to agree with you on that. Like, if you wanted to try to edit your stuff...
Oh, my God. It was so...
Such a waste of time.
And the requirements for that software, if you didn't follow it and set up your settings exactly... the right way, there was just no way it was going to stream off those disks if you didn't have your...
So pretty much any computer between the years of 1981 and 1987?
Yeah, good point.
You know, I remember the Wayframe with reverse time code.
But, you know, but some people...
Oh, yeah.
Director's beating me up.
But,
you know?
But that, to me, that just stood out. Maybe you guys don't have a piece of gear like that, you know, but I just wanted to open up if anybody has any piece of gear that they hated, that they just...
You know, I won't step on Scott's story. I'll let him tell it, but... I've never seen anyone go through what he went through. He just alluded to the Wayframe.
Well, I think we've had this. It was on podcast 20-something.
Did we talk about this?
Yeah.
I've never seen anybody's life so temporarily destroyed by technology. And that is what I think most of our most hateful moments come from, is when you've tried to advance the art and you've tried to use something new and you've tried to be on the cutting edge – and it just comes back to bite you.
Or you see a piece of gear and you scratch your head like, what the hell were they thinking? You know, like with the MIDI DJ back in the early 80s, you know, it's like, what the heck was that? Where you had 75 pages worth of menus, but you only had two, eight character eight LED, you know,
yeah, that reminds
numbers,
me.
You know,
the PPG wave term was probably my most hated thing like that, because it was what, like cryptic two letter abbreviations,
exactly,
of German words.
That's, exactly, that's the way MIDI
or
DJ
the
was.
Or the Yamaha TX rack, where you know, the entire synth
or
module
any synchronizer.
With a one character eight segment LED display. That's it.
But Mike, you used to mix with synchronizers. You'd sit there and you'd be hitting play, and all of a sudden, one of the machines decides just to go off in another direction.
Yeah, and it sounds like a helicopter going.
And you're like, what just happened? You know?
Yeah. Or
the sync lever, when it gets too hot, all of a sudden starts doing weird things.
Well, they just catch on fire.
So you just got to cool them off.
I thought you guys would have more more hateful gear. You know,
if we hated that much.
The biggest gear I think you hate is the gear that you love, you update it, and now it doesn't work, and now you despise it.
Yeah, I hate anything that's broken.
Yeah.
Despise it. I love anything that works.
Yeah.
Wow, a lot of love going around in this world.
Yeah,
I mean, I've had it happen. Like right now, I'm having a problem with a sequencer program, and it's actually Stevie's the one having the problem. And it's a reproducible problem. You know, the program's working great otherwise, but we have this reproducible problem that's stopping him getting work done, which means it's stopping me from getting sleep because I'm getting the phone calls every time it screws up. And we're not getting a solution, and it's really, really frustrating. And if there was a better solution, we'd probably be, you know, switching to it right now, but there isn't one.
And knowing Steve, he's probably not writing at like 2 o'clock in the afternoon, right?
No. Although recently it's been kind of 24/7. I never know when the problem's going to be. And it's a program that I love and I use all the time, but it's driving me crazy right now.
I think the thing, the technologies that you hate, are the technologies that are disposable. I mean, even cell phones. I mean, it doesn't work. So what? You paid $150 for it. Who cares? Or you paid $39 for it. What did you expect? It works well enough.
Cell phones, they don't fix. They just figure you'll get it.
And all
of
a sudden, I'm sitting there going, what, now I hit it, and like a second and a half, 2 seconds later, a digi comes up, says, beep, tick, beep. I'm like, why? How did it just get slower? You know, is it? You know.
It's a sample rate. Hey, Ken, do you have a piece of gear you don't like? Piece of gear you hate?
I don't like Pro Tools on a Windows machine. I hate that. But other than that, no.
Are you forced to use it sometimes?
60-foot pipe organ starter.
Just because the quick keys are all backwards.
Well, you can get a utility and swap it out.
You know what? I use Pro Tools on a Windows machine every day, and I so agree. I hate it. It does not work as good as an Apple. It just does not. Access violation errors all the time for no flipping reason. I had the place that sold this come out. They rebuilt the computer. Took me about 2 days. Boom, access violation. We redid all the drives, reformatted. It just does not work.
There was a version of Pro Tools, and I forgot which version it was. And anytime you tried to save the session, there was an error that came up, that there was an insertion error.
And then
you were screwed. So you couldn't save it. And you'd have to go do a backup and then track import it into a new – the session was corrupt. You were screwed.
Yeah.
I remember that.
I remember you got deadline. You're like, okay, I got like 10 minutes. I'm done. All I got to do is put it on the server. We're good. And it won't let you do it because there's one sound in 1,000 that's named wrong.
Yeah.
And you've got to find that sound.
Hey, yeah, you know what? I'm going to open this up. How does that happen where I import a bunch of tracks in and now I'm trying to make a save session copy and it's not letting me save session copy because it gives me an invalid name? How the hell did it
get a new version?
How did it get me into – how did it get into the session
what
in the first
version
place?
Of Pro Tools you running there?
I'm running 7.something or another.
Because maybe you did it consolidated.
Because it's gone now. I mean,
that's fixed now.
Okay, maybe it's 6.9.
I saw that look on your face. Yeah, well, here's why. Because it used to be that the Mac version allowed all Mac possible names.
Right.
But the PC is much more restrictive. And so there were situations where you could create something on a Mac in Mac world with Mac type files.
Right.
Then you try to convert it to PC type stuff and it's like, I can't do that.
Yeah, but I'm working on a Mac though, and the files were generated on a Mac. So how the heck?
Because it wants to be compatible.
Could they be incompatible?
Oh, well, probably
with
because you've gotten it from newer versions of Pro Tools. which are allowing more characters.
Right. No, I've gotten it from a Mac. Well, you know, I got it from OMFs because they're coming in OMFs straight into my Pro Tools system.
But if you have two sounds with exact same name,
well,
in, it,
in the current version, and I believe this works the same with OMF, though I'm not that familiar with it. If you open up anything, even a Pro Tools session that has stuff not named in a way that is now known to be compatible all over the place,
right.
It gives you a renamed audio files folder,
right.
Renames it, copies right. It, done. And then it's impossible for it to live in the session, whereas it used to be there were certain versions of the session that could deal with the names fine, so it just let them hang around. And then you try to save it as a different version because, yeah, well, that's not allowable anymore.
Right.
And you had to go figure it out yourself.
So what do you suggest?
You got to upgrade, which means you need a new computer.
I'm finishing. Here's the thing. Yeah, exactly, and we're not going to beat that dead horse, but every time I started a project and I'm going to upgrade at the end of that project because you never want to start a project and upgrade in the middle. And then another project comes in. So another project comes in. So it's like, all right. Well, I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to finish the project and copy all the data from that hard drive onto another hard drive so I have a backup. Upgrade the whole system with just software only. And then open up that session in the new version and then see if I can do a save, copy as, and consolidate it all down.
Yep.
Should work, right?
Should work.
All right.
Because it should rename stuff when it opens.
Yeah. Well, hey, listen, on that note, on that tech support call, which right now was the whole purpose of this podcast was to get that information. So thanks.
You didn't have to butter us up for 55 minutes for that.
Thanks, Andrew. Guys, anybody working on anything before we go? Anything interesting, Rob?
We're actually mixing a bunch of music for a video game that we're working on with Scott's company. And I will say that for the platform that it's going to be on, the sample rate has to be real low. So we're doing some stuff at 11K. It's unbelievable trying to make stuff sound good at 11K.
And the next version is all going to be an FM.
It's hilarious, though, trying to make this stuff sound good. And, you know, it still has to be within 11K, so it can only sound so good. But it's just a whole skill set that we never even thought about before, and I'm using WaveLab and a bunch of other things besides Pro Tools to just figure out the best way.
Have you checked that SoundMiner?
To transfer it to 11K?
Yeah.
No? It's no, I mean, WaveLab is doing it really well, but it's kind of like we're used to trying to master things for audiophile listeners
right.
and try to make it all sound incredibly good,
right.
And the assignment's the exact opposite.
Yeah, I mean, for the people who aren't geeky enough to know exactly what that limits you to, among other things, there's nothing above 5.5K.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Frequency-wise. So you've got to make it work. You know.
So cymbals, gone.
Top end of the voice, gone.
Yeah, you can make it work, but it's really challenging.
Basically sounds like your iPod.
No, I wish.
Wow.
But, so we're mixing all these songs for this game, and it's actually been a lot of fun because it's something – because of the 11K thing and the other way we have to deliver stuff, it's been sort of a new challenge. So that's been fun. And we still have a long way to go, but we're making a lot of progress, and it's been fun.
That's pretty funny. I'd love to hear that when I gets finished.
Well, I could play it for you, you know, over the phone. And it wouldn't sound all that different.
Andrew, you anything?
No, nothing. No. I got nothing. I'm not buying a pipe organ today.
We don't know that.
We don't
know.
There's
a few hours left.
That's true. No.
Scott?
I cleaned my room today.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, there you go.
Nice.
No, I'm right now I'm still doing Gears of War 2 and Fable 2. So that's keeping me probably busy till today.
That's great. And Ken, what about you?
I'm actually working on a mix for an album for a Northern California hip-hop band called Instant Messengers. That's pretty fun.
Oh, that's cool. Uh-huh.
Yeah. Working some of the beats out, doing some arrangements in the mix.
Great.
Yeah.
That's cool. Great.
Pretty excited about it.
What you got, Mike?
I'm starting another documentary. That's kind of fun. And trying to figure out how to back up the one that I just finished. So we'll see what happens when they cross like this, you know, back and forth. But that'll be kind of fun. That's a given, you know. I do. I buy a drive per project.
And then your old computer, just have it turn on once every week just to get the drives all spinning and refreshing the drives. And
gotcha.
There you go. All right.
Hey, before we go, I forgot.
I had to ask. Drives, you know?
I have this is another question that I have to get in here.
Yes.
Do any of you guys have hobbies outside of audio? Rob, do you have one? Guilty pleasure thing you like to do, anything?
I've started going to the gym again in the morning.
That's great.
That's a good, healthy kind of thing. It's a good stress reliever because the other 80% of my day is packed with stress. And there's something about being in the gym. It's hard to focus on anything stressful.
Andrew?
I spend a lot of time with the family.
Well, that's good.
That's kind of it. So, yeah, my hobbies are my kids' hobbies, you know, so whatever they're
video
into.
Games or...
A little bit of that, a lot of going to their concerts and shows and stuff, and yeah.
Because we had the question from one of our listeners who wanted to know what else we did, you know, hoping that we were just weren't all...
Look, we have no lives, you know, to be honest.
Yeah. I like watching reruns of Angelina Ballerina with my son.
No other hobbies besides audio, besides, you know?
Oh, for me, I mean, I sound silly, but like scuba diving, skiing, anything outside, as much as I can. I mean, anything that's on the water or below the water for me on an island is where I want to be when I'm not doing this.
In the 3 hours a year that you have free to
that's
do
pretty
it.
Much it.
Ken?
I like to hang out in the neighborhood, ride my bike around, whatever, you know, just hang out, have fun, go to the beach.
What's a bike?
You know,
do you have cards in the spokes?
Yeah,
right on.
No messing around here.
That's awesome.
What do you like to do, Mike?
Well, when I'm away from the media, because I do a lot of video and audio editing,
What do you do when you're not on a computer?
And when I'm not with the family, one of my really big interests, and it's every day I read more and more, and I'm like, is
Grand Potpourri?
No, I love robots.
Oh, there you go. That's cool.
I know, it's so geeky.
Right
Do you watch Robot Wars?
Yeah, but see, that's kind of boring. I mean, when I talk robots, I like things that for a purpose more than just, beating up each other. Cause, you know, the Robot Wars after a while was just one wedge against another wedge, and they're all trying to like get underneath so they can flip them over. It was really boring. But I like things like, I don't know if you're familiar. I just got my kids. There's this robotic toy called Pleo, and it's this robotic dinosaur that's just phenomenal.
Yeah,
it's phenomenal. It's the kids love it. It's like a pet. And I was in Sharper Image, and my little 5-year-old was getting a demo of Pleo, and it was so bizarre because I'm sitting there, and can we get a demo of this Pleo? Oh yeah. So the salesperson gets the dinosaur, puts it on the floor, turns it on. And then this little thing comes to life, and then my 5-year-old goes over there and starts petting it and starts playing with it. And I swear it was like from Blade Runner. I mean, it was just bizarre, like glimpse of the future where like we're not going to the pet store anymore. We're going to, you know, the electronics store to buy the latest pet. It was one of those moments. You talk about the, you know, scene into music. I mean, seeing a pet, because this little thing could react and it was.
And you're going to have to upgrade it.
Yeah. I've
already upgraded it. I've already
right.
Because
you know, I think we now know entirely why Mike had kids. If there was any doubt.
It was just, but it
so he doesn't seem so creepy going and playing with the toys. That's,
no, it was bizarre. I tell you, you know, the future is now. Some people say, you know, the future, it's not with a bang, but with a whisper. It just kind of slowly creeps up on you. The future is now. You're starting to see into music, and you're starting to have being able to buy a little artificial intelligent little pets, you know, so we'll see where it goes.
So as soon as this recession's over, we'll all be buying tons of that stuff.
That's right. All right, well.
Hey, 100 years ago, people were riding to work on a horse. I mean, things have improved pretty rapidly over the last few years.
Yeah.
These are actually pretty small changes compared to what's happened in the last century.
But, you know, when you actually talk about that, I created my company, my interactive company. We're about 16 years old. And I remember the year I started it, a guy came down to a seminar and said, look, because we were learning Unix and doing something on the well. And he goes, there's a new thing called the World Wide Web, WWW, that they're going to be like releasing, you know, some blah, blah month. And I'm thinking, oh, okay. And when you think about your life on the web, whether it be finance or how it's changed your life, it's only been a little over a decade.
Oh, yeah.
What's the web?
It wasn't that long ago that when you needed a new version of software, like a new version of Microsoft Word, you would call Microsoft, order floppies, which would then get mailed to you. Yeah. That's not that long ago.
And now it's, you know, changed music, it's changed video, it's changed commerce.
It's a wonderful thing. Well, hey, on that note, we've gone kind of long, so we're going to end this podcast. But hey, guys, you know what? Future is now. It's a great time to be alive. If you have any comments, you can reach us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com.
That's where?
audio@nowcastnetwork.com.
Where?
And you can check out our MySpace page, myspace.com/audionowcast. All right, for myself and all the guys, thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Apex and Westwave Audio. The Audio Nowcast is hosted by Mike Rodriguez with Rob Arbatier, Scott Gershon, Martin Page, Andrew Sheps, and Bobby Summerfield. The program is produced by April Mastropaulo and uses Apex's 230 Master Channel Voice Processor. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
Wow, you should not swallow and try to talk at the same time.